Welcome back to the program. New York in the late 70s. It was a time that is often derided today, yet it was a time of great artistic expression, of raw energy, of diversity. A time before homogenization and Disneyfication took over New York. It was a time when graffiti was everywhere, and the practitioners of the art were seen as both famous and anonymous. It was a time of art and a time of vandalism. And it's the jumping-off point for my guest Adam Mansbach's new novel, Rage Is Back. Adam Mansbach's previous work include Go to F to Sleep and Angry Black White Boy. It is my pleasure to welcome Adam Mansbach here to talk about his newest work, Rage Is Back. Adam Mansbach, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. It's hard to remember, but there was a time when graffiti was everywhere in New York, where there wasn't a subway car that wasn't tagged.
That's absolutely right. And that was really the case from the late 60s until about 1990, when the city's war on graffiti, as declared by Mayor John Lindsay in 1972, finally sort of succeeded in eradicating the art or the vandalism from the trains. It took them $300 million in about 18 years, but they finally did it.
And it is amazing that that world, at least so it seemed, just went away, that the practitioners, the people that were involved in it, just kind of disappeared.
Yeah, it's a strange thing because you had this generation of artists in the odd position of having effectively outlived the thing that they'd created, and this sort of forced them to live in the past. Graffiti at that point had gone worldwide. There were graffiti scenes and are graffiti scenes flourishing in every city on the planet. But in terms of that original context of New York subway trains, which incubated the scene and created the aesthetics, yeah, it vanished in 1990.
And of course, it was part of a much larger scene, the whole hip-hop culture of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's important to remember that just as graffiti was criminalized at that time and continues to be today, the other elements of hip-hop were also criminalized. Kids were getting arrested for breakdancing in the subway stations because the dance form to outsiders, to the uninitiated, looked so aggressive that people would call the cops, like, these kids are about to fight. You know, the mythic parties that were thrown in the schoolyards of the Bronx that incubated all of the various art forms of hip-hop, DJing and MCing and dance, these were often broken up because the kids throwing them had no permits. So the war on graffiti is part of a larger context of a kind of clash between youth and authority that was really taking on new levels of importance and depth in the early 70s through the late 80s.
The other conflict that seemed to underlie it all was this battle between art on the one hand and vandalism on the other, and which was which.
Yeah, absolutely. And one reason that I was so attracted to this world of graffiti and wanted to set a novel there is because, you know, I think that narrative and conflict in literature really stems from paradox. And to me, growing up, the graffiti writers I saw were very good at embracing and kind of holding these paradoxical ideas in their minds and in their lives at once. So for most of these guys, it wasn't that it was art, not vandalism. It was that it was both simultaneously, and that's where the joy and the adventure came from. There was fame and anonymity. And, you know, a lot of graffiti writers use the words beautify and destroy almost interchangeably in describing their relationships to the cities in which they live and work.
And one of the things that's clear, and you carry this theme into the story, the adventure story that's part of Rage Is Back, is that the city and those in power at the time knew they were opposed to it, they knew they wanted to create this war on it, but they really didn't understand it at all.
No, they didn't. And that's clear in the ways in which a lot of the tactics deployed by the city in the war weren't just unsuccessful, but backfired, because they were based on a misunderstanding of the psychology of these graffiti writers. For example, the city at one point thought that it would demoralize the writers if all of the trains suddenly were cleaned at once. So, you know, they went from being heavily painted to, you know, completely white. So they had all these city employees work overtime, work double and triple shifts, and they rolled out the Great White Fleet. And rather than be demoralized, this actually solved the problem of artistic overcrowding. And a lot of graffiti writers who had already retired were so excited by this new development that they came out of retirement and started painting again. So there were a lot of ways in which the city, yeah, misfired in its tactics, didn't understand what was at stake for these kids or the way that they thought either.
The city also wanted to make it a larger metaphor for the other problems that were facing the city at the time, which had nothing to do with graffiti.
Yeah. I mean, to think that the city spent $300 million fighting a problem which existed on trains and yet didn't stop the trains from running, didn't affect service, is kind of phenomenal. In a lot of ways, the war on graffiti was really a war on young people of color, young poor people of color. And the thinking behind a lot of these tactics actually opened the door for today's climate of zero tolerance policy, quality of life offenses, the elevation of misdemeanors to felonies, the spread of prejudicial gang databases, epic incarceration. All of those things are kind of midwifed, in a sense, by the war on graffiti.
The graffiti was the same as the squeegee guys. I mean, it was part of the same lifestyle attack.
Yeah, I would agree, although I think there's a lot more artistic brilliance in the graffiti
than in the squeegee guys.
not to insult the squeegee guys.
Talk a little bit about where all these artists went. Once it was over, where did they go?
A lot of them didn't go anywhere. A lot of them are right where they've always been. They're in Brooklyn, they're in the Bronx, they're in Manhattan. Some of them are very famous, and yet that fame doesn't translate into being able to make a living. There have been various flirtations with the world of fine arts. You know, in 1981, 82, a lot of these 15, 16-year-old graffiti writers were suddenly being exhibited in galleries and making good money. A lot of them are highly praised and valued in Europe. A lot of guys transitioned into careers in graphic design or advertising. In fact, the way that advertising looks today is largely dictated by the style and the aesthetics of graffiti, this notion of logo repetition and logo recognition, particularly on trains and in other public spaces. Other guys, you know, stopped writing because they went to college. And other guys had their lives ruined by their devotion to and passion for graffiti. There are people serving sentences up to 8 years in jail right now for graffiti. There were guys who were really, you know, graffiti addicts. I mean, there's a rush associated with this craft, and it definitely derailed a lot of lives.
And in fact, your central character in Rage Is Back is the son of one of the famous graffiti artists of the time.
That's right. He's actually the son of two. His parents are both famous graffiti writers in their own right, and there were women on the scene as well. Yeah, and he's sort of the inheritor of all of this lore. The book takes place in 2005, long after this war has been fought and lost, and he's sort of grown up within the matrix of graffiti culture, but, you know, it's his parents' thing, and it's not necessarily his passion or anything that he cares that deeply about, except that it's a way to understand his parents, who are perplexing and somewhat absent figures, at least initially, in the book.
And talk about his father, Billy Rage, who's at the center of this, who comes back.
Yes. When the book opens, Billy has been gone for 16 years. He was sort of forced to flee the city and the country because he was being prosecuted in civil and criminal court for his art crimes after attempting to use graffiti as a way to call attention to a murder committed by a corrupt cop. He was sort of hounded out of the city, and he's been, as we'll learn, in the Amazon basin studying shamanic healing techniques. He makes his way back to New York City, and his son finds him essentially in a kind of feral, broken state. But over the course of the book, there'll be a kind of epic comeback by this crew, this decimated crew of writers from the 80s who have faded into the woodwork, but will regather and attempt to bring down this cop who is now running for mayor by this through an epic caper which involves painting every train in the New York City subway system at once.
And what it really brings up is this point we were talking about before, is that those in power, the guy that was the cop then that's running for mayor now, never really understood what this was about in the first place.
Right. That's absolutely right. It was really an attempt to contain a youth movement and at the same time to ignore the content of what that youth movement was about. You know, this is New York City in an era where it was moving from a sort of policy of abandonment of poor neighborhoods and of people of color to a policy of profound confinement and containment. And that's the greater context. But you had on the ground these transit cops, these vandal squad cops, and there's still a vandal squad in New York, who were themselves almost like writers. I mean, they were chasing 15-year-old kids around the tunnels. They were almost like 15-year-old kids themselves. They would bring paint to the train yards and cross out the work of writers they didn't like. They would provoke beef between crews by inserting themselves into this sort of internecine world of graffiti. I mean, they were just as passionate and just as sort of obsessed with graffiti as the writers.
What do you think kids understand about this today, even in New York?
I think there's a real generation gap with graffiti and with the original context of hip-hop itself. You know, I was teaching a college course on hip-hop at Rutgers University a couple of years ago, and I had to constantly remind myself that the context in which I understood hip-hop as coming out of particular conditions in the 70s, you know, post-industrial Bronx, the Cross Bronx Expressway having decimated neighborhoods and caused middle-class flight, and the shutdown of all of these industries, and immigration from the West Indies, and sort of marginalization across the board, you know, schools that were falling apart, buildings that were being set on fire for the insurance money. The kids who are coming up today have only known hip-hop as popular culture, as mass culture, as what's available on the radio and is totally mainstream. So I think there's a disconnect from the notion that hip-hop was sort of birthed out of struggle and as a brilliant response to the kind of marginalization that young people in New York City face.
One of the things I read somewhere is that you have a mixtape that's going to go along with the audiobook version of this.
Yeah, yeah. We have a mixtape project which is being helmed by a great DJ named Jay Period, who's one of the greats of the mixtape scene. He does these projects that are incredibly involved and narrative. They're almost like biographies of the artists. He has a famous Lauryn Hill tape. He has a famous one that he did with Nas. He's done tapes for The Roots. Of course, I use the term tape very loosely here. There's no cassette actually involved in
right.
this. But, you know, because he's so good at what he does, I wanted to explore with him the notion of a mixtape as a companion to a novel. So he and I got together and sort of plotted out what that means. The first single from the mixtape was released about a week and a half ago, and it's called The Rage Is Back Freestyle, and it features Black Thought from The Roots doing an original song, and it kind of blew up all over the internet. People definitely were feeling it. So the second single will drop in about another week, and then the whole project will come out on February 12th. And it's a companion piece to the novel. It's not an audiobook, because there is an audiobook
right.
read by Danny Hock, the Jizza from the Wu-Tang Clan, and Wyatt Cenac from The Daily Show. That's my audiobook cast, which I'm quite thrilled about. But the mixtape will be a different sort of standalone project that hopefully explores another dimension and gives a kind of sonic companion to the book.
You think graffiti will ever make a comeback?
Well, you know, graffiti is actually flourishing on a worldwide level. I mean, there are graffiti books proliferating, not novels. I think this is the only graffiti novel that I'm aware of, but art books. A lot of guys are making good careers, and just as notably to me is that a lot of graffiti writers have figured out how to make graffiti a teaching tool and use it to bring young people into a life of art. And I don't mean illegal art. I mean that there's, you know, here in the Bay, for instance, Estria, great writer Estria, founded the Estria Foundation, which is doing murals all over the world to bring attention to critical issues of the day. And a lot of young people are being ushered into this form by guys who 20 years ago might have been bombing trains, bombing, of course, I mean painting. It's
mm-hmm.
a graffiti term. But today are really invested in ushering young people into a life of creativity.
Adam Mansbach, his new novel is Rage Is Back. Adam, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you. Been a pleasure.
Appreciate it.